This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Wawa West Africa, a coming-of-age memoir, and the author is William Coghlan. And we welcome Bill to Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Hello, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Wawa West Africa. Well, this is a different view. Often people say, hey, this is pretty serious stuff. How can you be laughing? But we're going to get into why you take this tack, what you're trying to say to the world. I want to read what you have written just to set the stage for everyone. You say this: this book is an exciting, adventurous story for young readers and old that traces the humorous tales of living in many cultures and societies and eventually coming of age. Once the reader learns what a Wawa is, they will find it in the story along the way and eventually apply it to their lives. Now, this view of life, does this come from your African background?
Yes, it comes from my life of living in West Africa and adopting the local Pidgin English language and applying the way people view the world. I'm writing it, of course, from a child's point of view.
You kept your memoirs since you were young.
No, I kept it from the time I was 18 in college.
Okay.
And I wrote about it from 1970 until now.
So it's been a long journey of just remembering and trying to apply it to this point of view, this Wawa point of view, if you will.
Yes. I tried to recover and rescue my own humanity of my childhood.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that I thought that I had always felt that my childhood was a very happy time in my life, but I didn't kind of know why until I sat down to write this. And I didn't even know as I was writing it until I saw it. I discovered the quality and texture of the humor and the point of view of West Africans about the world.
So that is a very important time in your life, and you learned a lot.
Right. Well, I learned that, as Freud would point out, your childhood is who you are as an adult in a way. And this points out who I am as a person today. I mean, I still use the concept of Wawa and Juju, which is magic, for today's life, because I think that having a sense of humor and having a sense of wonder about the world are important attributes of being creative in the world.
Help us better understand how this Wawa came about. Where does it come from?
Well, it's Pidgin English for West Africa Wins Again, and it's a sort of form of cultural resistance by Africans to the complexities of life around them and to the adverse conditions of life and to the difficulties of life. I mean, for example, a canoe full of fish may come in through the surf and turn over, and the Africans will say, "Wah, wah." And one might say, "Why do they laugh?" Well, they laugh because there's no other thing to do with a tragedy like that but laugh at it.
And also, of course, West Africa, one time, and I'm not sure how long, was a colony, and it had that kind of, there was that kind of cultural resistance, I'm sure, against the Europeans, but
right.
They had to deal with it some way.
Right. Well, not only the Europeans, but also the general Western view of the world, that you can do certain things, but Africa resists them, and they are not possible.
You went to school in England as well. What did you learn from school in England?
Well, in school in England, I learned that society can be very structured. Everything has its place, its class, its function, and everything has a certain different structure to it. I learned that, for example, there's no sense of democracy, that every form or class room had its own tradition, and you couldn't enter one class from another class. And when my brother and I protested that we believed in democracy, we got thrown out of those forums anyway.
And then you lived in Switzerland. There was a coming of age there. What did you learn?
Well, I learned that, I learned that coming of age is a more complex matter than I thought it was. It wasn't as simple as I thought it would be, and it wasn't just fun, but it was a different sort of responsibility about the world and how relations among and between people are more difficult than I thought they would be.
So as you look at your different experiences in Africa and England and Switzerland, how do you compare them? What do you, how do they intersect in your life, and what do you learn from each one of them and also them together?
Well, I think that what happens is if you take Wawa as an overall point of view, you learn that you don't control as much of the world as you think you do. And with letting control not be a central issue in your life, you are actually freed up a little bit, ironically, and you feel your freedom better because you realize your freedom is not based on how much you control the world, but how much you enjoy the world.
Now, what about this term, juju?
Juju is a different kind of term. Juju is a sort of serious term. Juju can happen to you. It can be caused by your relatives, your enemies, your friends. It's anywhere that affects you negatively or positively. There's good juju and bad juju. Good juju may be your juju, which hopefully offsets the juju of other people against you. And bad juju is people wishing bad things against you and having bad things happen to you. It's where the Africans used to say, this thing be juju, meant that they would not do that thing or they would not be involved with that.
So the juju becomes a taboo, if you will.
Yes. It's a sort of way to look at taboo of different sorts and put taboo on different kinds of behavior. But it can be, it's very different than the scientific point of view. It doesn't have it has a sort of personal ring to it. And it didn't last as much as I think the more positive wah-wah does. It's a more limiting thing.
Now, there's another word that you talk about that best describes this story. And how do you say that? It begins with Y?
Yakati.
Yakati.
Mm-hmm. Yakati means finished, over, done with, or that's the end of it. So Yakati is something that's finished and not going to happen again, and it's out of sight. Or out of mind.
You talk about this time of unprecedented globalization. Through this memoir, you seem to be trying to find, you're searching for some kind of compassion, connection, and you even say a reverence for difference. Make some comments about that.
Yeah. A reverence for difference means that I'm reaching out to discover what does it mean to have a best friend who's a witch doctor and not knowing exactly how to embrace that, but put your arms around it and say that's the way it is because that was his world, or whether if the cats, his cats had to be fed cat food, he would have to hunt for bats out of a cave and put a net and cut their throats and feed them to his cats, and how that was different. Or a duiker running around in the backyard and the help going out and capturing the duiker and cutting it up and putting it in their stew. In other words, embracing a different kind of environment and milieu.
Well, one of the messages that you want everyone to understand, that you say nothing ventured, nothing gained. Why? I mean, we've heard that many times. Why is that applicable in your memoirs?
Well, I think you want. I can't say how Wawa works for everybody else because each person has their own set of values about what's funny and what's humorous about the world. But what I'm saying is, if they open themselves up to the possibility of looking at Africa and seeing these cultures, of which there were many, Ghana, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Liberia, then it becomes possible to see that even though they're Africa, they are civilized in their own way, and they are places that you can learn about people and places that you can learn about yourself as a traveler through these various cultures.
Another message that you're advocating, flexibility is the concrete expression of the initiative.
Yes. Flexibility is the concrete expression of the initiative is a wah-wah because wah-wah is very flexible. It says that you never know what contradictions of humor you're going to find, but when you do, you have to be open to them, because if you're not open to them, you're going to miss out on the richness and the texture of life and living.
So we need just to lighten up and even embrace, as you put it, embrace laughing at the world.
Yes, but I'm more than laughing at the world, laughing with the world as well. I'm saying that generically, nature has incorporated humor in the world, and if we want to be part of the world, it's not just our adversarial us against them, it's also us with them.
So there is a universal message of humor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think humor. Well, Mark Twain, of course, was a great American humorist, and I'm right now following the PBS series about that. And I think he had a message of humor in his time, and I'm, in a small way, am trying to bring the message of humor in the 50s in West Africa.
The title of the book, Wawa West Africa, a coming-of-age memoir. William Coghlan is the author. William, tell us how to get your book.
You get the book from Balboa Press, and I have a website. Actually, I have two websites, www.coopgroups.com. And on the first page of that website, it says, see the other book. And you go to that, see the other book, and it'll go to the Wawa website. Okay?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bill, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on Toginet.com.
Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on TogiNet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Written in the Ashes, and the author is Kay Holland Van Zandt. And Kaya joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Kaya.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Written in the Ashes. This is an epic. It's a historical novel. For those who love history, this is a must read. Let me share with everyone what you've written. It's 5th century Alexandria, Egypt. Paganism is declared punishable by death, and the populace splinters in religious upheaval. Hannah, a beautiful Jewish shepherd girl kidnapped and sold as a slave, is unknowingly destined to become a popular bard in the great library. But when Hannah becomes the bishop's target, she is sequestered across the harbor in the Temple of Isis, where the ancient ceremony ignites a forbidden passion. Well, we could just talk about that paragraph. We wouldn't have to go anywhere else. What was the genesis of this, Kaya? This is an incredible story.
Thank you. I've always had an interest in history, and it came more out of passion than some kind of, you know, scholarly curiosity. And then eventually, you know, I started doing research also. But really, it came out of a lot of discussions and arguments with a gentleman who I was dating at the time about the Great Library of Alexandria. And he was in school at UC Berkeley, and so knew a great deal about the subject. He's getting his degree in Egyptology. And he insisted that nobody knew when the Great Library burned. And I just found that particularly difficult to believe, because we know what Caesar was having for breakfast on the morning of his battles, and yet we don't know when the greatest library in antiquity burned to the ground. It just seemed impossible to me. So I got curious, which is always dangerous, because I spent the next 10 years of my life writing and researching just on this subject.
Well, and you were inspired by Tom Robbins.
Yes, my mentor is author Tom Robbins, who's pretty well known for Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, which was turned into a film by Gus Van Sant. Tom is a very witty American humorist. He reminds me a lot of Mark Twain. And there's no one on this planet more serious about writing than Tom Robbins. And I think early on, a young, you know, 20-something, my ego was like, oh, I hope Tom, you know, will help the book and help me get published and all that. But what really happened was he got me very serious about my grammar and about the necessary passion and dedication that it takes to actually write something with beautiful sentences in it, not just a great story, but something that, whereas readers roll along in the book, they come to moments of inspiration or of wisdom or of great feeling and compassion where they're actually, they pause for a moment, they put the book down because something has touched them. So that was the book that I longed to write, that I was guided to write by Tom.
Yeah, just an example, all trees hold secrets, from tiny saplings just piercing the earth to old sentinels that stretch toward the sky until they ponder what the trees have witnessed. We can only dream. There's a little of your writing. I love it. You just create great pictures.
Thank you.
Great pictures. And so, okay, let's get into 5th century Alexandria, Egypt. Who is Hannah? Let's talk more about Hannah.
Hannah was my window into the story. Originally, I began researching about Hypatia, who was the great headmistress of the library at that time, who's a young woman single-handedly running the library, but she's brutally murdered by the Christians. And I must say, I think I was raised on a bit too much Disney to murder my protagonist. I just couldn't have the heart to do that to my readers.
Especially a female protagonist.
Yeah, right? So I needed another window in, and it was not really, Hannah and discovering her was not really a conscious choice. I began to work on the story, and Hannah just leapt onto the page fully clad, like, you know, Athena out of Zeus's head. She just appeared and said, this is going to be my story. And then I really got that I had this incredible opportunity to write the female hero's journey, which hadn't really been done except for maybe Clan of the Cave Bear or Myths of Avalon. We always get the male hero's journey. So I wanted to, you know, go deeper into the questions of, like, well, what are women up against in their own hero's journey? And one of her main both gifts and challenges is the discovery of her voice. She's a singer. She's an incredible singer. And she also ends up becoming a slave. She's kidnapped and sold as a slave in Alexandria. So in order for her to really redeem herself and save herself, as we're all meant to do in the hero's journey, she has to find her voice. And ultimately, it's her voice that ends up becoming the incredible beacon, not only for herself, but for the other characters in the story.
And you say the seat of Western civilization stands on the brink of destruction, so there's great upheaval in Alexandria.
Yes, at that time, about 20 years earlier, the Emperor Theodosius II had made all pagan practice punishable by death. Now, and that means pagan, not like just people who are out in the forest, you know, celebrating the trees. Pagan means astronomers, mathematicians. Pagan means the very sciences that we take very seriously today were deemed black magic by the Christians of the era. So anyone in the Great Library who was a philosopher, who was interested in medicine and even how the heart beats in the human body, was in danger of being killed by the Christian regime. And the Christian regime in Alexandria at this time was merciless under Bishop Cyril. He took it to genocidal extremes when he exiled a quarter of the city's population. That's about 250,000 Jews into the desert overnight, and continued to persecute women, accusing them of black magic and sorcery. And he was actually the first of the Christians to do so, and some sources cite him as having been the inspiration for the entire witch hunts that came in many, many centuries later to follow, because he was so successful at this kind of persecution, unfortunately. So if you weren't a Christian at the time, your life was in danger. So that meant the Jews, that meant the priests of Osiris, that meant the Mithraic religions, and then also the ones that that are the sciences today.
Tell us about Alizar, Hannah's new master.
Yes, Alizar was the first character who came to me in the story. And I was, you know, I was interested in Elaine Pagels and the Gnostic Gospels. And if you're not familiar with it, in the last century, there have been a lot of really incredible documents discovered around the Mediterranean, one of which is the library at Nag Hammadi. And this is essentially a shepherd who bumped his foot on a clay pot that was buried in the ground and turned up these incredible documents that had been submerged in this clay pot. And I thought, wow, who in the world 1,500 years ago had the foresight to realize that the libraries were in danger and that the Christians were burning the libraries, because they didn't just burn the Great Library, they actually burned the libraries at Antioch and Ephesus and Pergamon before that. So somebody said, uh-oh, I better make sure that we can save some of these important texts. And so began burying these clay pots, much like time capsules for later discovery, which is what happened. So that was the birth of the character Alizar, who's a vintner in the Mediterranean. And to be honest, I really based him on a cross between Winston Churchill and Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird. I wanted somebody with an incredible amount of nobility and esteem and honor to be doing this, because he's risking his life, the lives of his family, and his own business in order to secure these documents for future generations. He's really the visionary of the story. So although Hannah is kidnapped from her father in the hills of Sinai and sold in Alexandria, she ends up with a good master and a good home and someone who wants to see her become educated, which was very valuable for a slave at that time. As a slave, if you could become educated, you were considered of great value. And he even gives her the opportunity to earn her freedom if she's able.
Hannah's singing also wins the love of the headmistress of the great library.
Yes, our talents are always a doorway into a greater life if we choose to be brave enough to spend time nurturing them. So I wanted to give Hannah that opportunity to become brave enough to get noticed a little bit and to become a little celebrated so that her real adventures can begin.
And the headmistress, her name is?
Hypatia. Sometimes
Hypatia.
She's called Hypatia.
Okay. And she wants to protect her.
Yeah, absolutely. They become friends.
And that's an important part of the story, as well as this quest, the quest for finding the Emerald Tablet of Alexander the Great.
Yes. The book is, if history is the bones of this book, I think myth and mythology is its blood. There's a great deal of heat that comes into play as Hannah goes through the story, and she has two suitors, so there's quite a love triangle going on, a passionate love triangle with two men who really represent the incredible, divine, unattainable love and the human love that we all have the opportunity to experience here. So it's through that love, one of those loves, that she's informed that if we can find the Emerald Tablet of Alexander the Great, that it could potentially be enough to silence the bishop of the city. So she's tasked with this quest to visit the ancient oracles of the day, and it's the last summoning of both oracles of Delphi outside the Athens in Greece, and also the oracle of Amun-Ra deep in the desert in the Siwa Oasis. So she has quite a quest in front of her.
Now, your timeline on this story, explain the common era.
Well, we most know it as A.D. Most people think A.D. stands for after death, but that's not the case. It's Latin, and it means Anno Domini. And it isn't in use anymore within scholarly circles. In fact, if you're in a university, they won't let you use it at all. So it's so C.E. is the non-religious term, especially since I'm dealing with Jews and pagans in this story. I didn't want to use the religious term Anno Domini. I wanted to keep it more neutral. So that's what C.E. means. It means common era.
Now, one of the messages of your book, you say women were of more importance in the ancient world than history books would have you believe.
Yeah, this is a subject really close to my own heart, because I was raised in America, in Los Angeles. I was given a fantastic private school education. And to be perfectly honest with you, by the time I graduated from high school, I could not name more than 6 or 8 women who contributed to the pages of history. And when it came to my awareness that there were more women out there who had made incredible contributions through history, I felt like the blinders were removed, because I just didn't realize that that had been the case, or even that it was possible for women to do such great contributing to our world. So personally, it was a great victory to discover Hypatia, that here was a woman who was not born into her position. She's not a princess. She's not a queen. She is someone who's been educated by her father, who has since passed away. But it's the power of her own gravitas, her beauty, her incredible imagination, her inventiveness. She was the first female mathematician, scientist, and philosopher in history, and she was so celebrated at the time she was alive that emperors and magistrates and kings would sail from all over the Mediterranean to sit at her feet to learn from her. She had a school, so they often would join her school. Some of them came to her with problems to solve, like, how can I check to see if the wine in my barrels is done, you know, before I spoil a barrel to open it? And she would solve these riddles for people. So she was an extraordinary woman. And it was an extraordinary change for me, and I realized for others around me. I mean, I've since spoken with graduates of Oxford who also couldn't name more than 10 women who contributed to history. But when you really pull the blinders off and you start realizing, oh my gosh, you know, most people don't even know who someone like Benazir Bhutto was, that there's a great deal of education for us in realizing how amazing these women are from history.
Kaya, we have about a minute left, but I wanted you to comment on this other key message. Follow your bliss. Listen to the voice inside you that knows what you love, what you resonate with, and trust it.
That's a quote, actually. Well, the first part of it, follow your bliss, is a quote from Joseph Campbell, who's been an incredible inspiration in my life. And I believe it's true. You've got to follow your bliss in this world, because that's when you'll be the happiest, and that's when you'll be contributing the most your spirit and heart have to offer to the world around you.
Kaya, share one of the reviewers of your book.
Well, I'm thrilled to say that the book is being shopped for a mini-series right now by Academy Award-winning producer Mark Harris, who won Best Picture for Crash in 2005, and he writes, a stunning epic about the burning of the Great Library of Alexandria, Egypt, from a brilliant young novelist whose depiction of the ancient world is sure to capture the hearts of readers everywhere.
The title of the book, Written in the Ashes. The author is Kay Holland Van Zandt. Kaya, tell us how to get your book.
You can order it off of Amazon. It's available in Kindle and hardback and soon paperback editions. You can also get it from Barnes & Noble websites.
Thanks, Kaya, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing and this interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thank you, Kaya.
Thanks very much, Steve.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Want to be challenged in a powerful way to leap beyond what you think is possible? Then join us Mondays for the Leah Jansen Show, every Monday at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com with Leah Jansen. Listen live as life coach Leah uses her coaching skills to give you the tools you need to take action and create momentum. You are encouraged to call in and share your greatest fears, challenges, and obstacles. And then listen as Leah obliterates those barriers to success. For more on Leah and the show, check out her website, leahjansen.com. That's Leah, LEAHJANTZEN.com. Spend 1 hour with Leah, and you'll be captivated by her energy, enthusiasm, and magnetism. You'll quickly become addicted to her positive attitude and make-it-happen mentality. Ready for a life-changing, mood-altering show? Then get ready for Leah Jansen and listen live to The Leah Jansen Show every Monday morning at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole O'Dell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole O'Dell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Mind Your Own Life, The Journey Back to Love. And the author is Aaron Anson. And Aaron joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, good morning, Steve.
Well, good to have you with us. I'm going to read what you've written about your book, Mind Your Own Life, The Journey Back to Love. You say this, Aaron Anson is an inspirational writer and new thought coach who is married and lives in Washington, D.C. with his partner, Oliver. He has appeared on a number of literary programs and radio broadcasts. Raised a black devout Christian in the South, his learned beliefs about religion contradicted the inherent knowing that he was a gay man. Endeavoring to uphold instilled beliefs, he married and fathered two children, expecting that suppression and denial would allow him to escape the ambiguity of being gay with Christian beliefs. So you've been down this road that has been very challenging for you. Why publish the book, Aaron?
Well, you know, as I was writing the book, I realized, and I was talking with other people that were in my inner circle, how the book could benefit so many others that were like struggling with some of the same issues, being gay, and of course raised in a society that was totally kind of anti-gay or sort of gravitated toward not being gay. So it was a struggle, and it's just meant to reach the masses and benefit those that are struggling, not just being gay, but with other issues in their life as well.
So when you say mind your own life, what does that actually mean?
Well, the book is about so much of our life has been dictated by others, and we've come here not knowing the language or anything, and all the things that we believe in our lives now, all the things that we come to accept is truth, or truth that are handed down to us by others. I mean, we didn't come here believing anything. So then we get these very staunch, viewpoints. And that is where the mind comes in. And that's where Mind Your Own Life is about, somewhere finding yourself in the midst of all the bombardment, of all the rhetoric, whether it's political, religious, or whatever, and minding your own life.
You talk about growing up as a confused, closeted gay in a deeply religious South. Tell us about what you went through.
Well, like I tell, I can't tell people all the time. I was actually raised to be straight and heterosexual, and it was a major, area of anxiety and depression for me for a lot of years to deal with something that I inherently felt inside, myself, and then I was being kind of corralled, completely against, what I felt as a human being. So, yeah, I ended up going in the military, and, of course, that experience being totally opposite, which is where, I was exposed to more, gay and homosexuality than I had in all my, years in the civilian world. So, yeah, it was a very confused time for me in my life, and I used religion mostly as the basis to try to, reconcile the differences.
Well, you say you really struggled with depression for some time, and with denial and acceptance, I guess all rolled into one.
Absolutely. I end up, all in the name of my religion and trying to please society and people around me. I actually married. I end up fathering two wonderful children. All this, trying to escape the ambiguity of it, and at the same time live a life that was accepting and being accepted by others, or acceptable by others.
So how long were you married?
15 years.
15 years. Now, during that time, did your wife understand what you were going through?
Absolutely not. No, I was, I mean, I it was secret. It was just a secret that I was harboring inside, that I was dealing inside. And although I never acted on it, because I used religion as my basis for so many years to try and correct, you know, what I had been taught was a defect, you know, in my genetics per se. It was only after I told my wife, you know, when I really came to just, you know, the cusp of probably suicide and everything else, that was when I actually told her what I was dealing with on the inside. And she, like, I think like a lot of, you know, people that love you, you know, she assumed it was her fault and it was something that she did. And you know, took forever to explain to her that it had absolutely nothing at all to do with her.
In a chapter of Called Awareness, you have a section, The Marriage Myth. Why don't you share with us what that is about?
Well, the marriage myth is totally about this, where we've created, you know, these relationships around, you know, around religion and what a marriage should represent and what it should mean. And then we as society, you know, we all have our, I guess we have our secrets individually, or we live our own lives kind of individually, but so much of it is based on what we've been taught to believe, you know, in a relationship, in a marriage. And you like, in my life, in my marriage, I was totally into marriage for a lot of years, and I was into my marriage. I love my wife and I love my kids, but it was very superficial in the sense that I was not allowed to be myself, and as a consequence, I denied her, you know, the right to be in a relationship that, you know, that she could totally embrace and that totally embraced her.
You also have a section called The American Nightmare.
Well, that I get into the fact that, you know, I talked about earlier beliefs in the program, and, you know, I feel that we've been taught, you know, so many things, you know, not that have been handed down to us that we've accepted as our own truth. So you get into this thing of, okay, well, I should, you know, go to college, get a 4 or 5 year degree, you know, go get a good job, stay like 50, 60 years or 40, 50 years and retire. And I think that has become like a myth in the fact that we bought into this, and meanwhile, we've set false, expectations of what our life should be here on the universe, where it should be one of love, and not should be one consumed with what material things we accomplish here on the universe and in the earth. And that was a big thing for me, because I hid behind a lot of that stuff, you know, accumulating houses and accumulating wealth. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I've done very well in my life, but it was, you know, it was all initially started just, you know, it was to cover up being who I was as an individual on the planet, in the universe.
You have some strong things, strong feelings about how the Bible deals with this whole controversy amongst some about being gay.
Yes, I do. The biggest problem I have with the Bible, and keep in mind, I was raised in the black religious community, and I think it's become this misconception that so many years, you know, we have been purported, you know, things about the Bible and what the Bible says. But I think it's important to get back to the history of the Bible. And I say, especially in, I know the churches and things that I were involved in that I grew up in, getting back to the basics of understanding the historical prominence of the Bible, and that the Bible was not written by Jesus or God. And so I'm a little perturbed sometimes when I hear, you know, preachers get in the pulpit and they start out what Jesus said or did or God said that, and neither one of them wrote about these. Bibles were written by people just like you and I, and the Bible is more a library as opposed to like this Bible that was never intended to even be a Bible. It was just other people's interpretation of events. But more important, Steve, is the initial Bible was written in Hebrew and Greek, and it was translated to English, and mere translation is interpretation. You got to guess what the writer meant and what the writer was trying to say. So to be purporting and re-purporting things 2,500 years down the line, I think we should at least question those things. I'm not here to say I'm like anti or pro the Bible. I just say let's look at it realistically and let's find our own truth, you know, within this.
Under part 4 in your book of religious rhetoric, you have a heading, that is stated perpetuating hate.
Yeah, I think that has that's happened a lot in the pulpit, especially, you know, there were several big preachers throughout our history, and this is across, you know, all religious genres or whatever, but, you know, when they get into the pulpit and they're preaching hate against, you know, people that have abortion or gays, and it's like, here's we have religious leaders, you know, that are supposed to be teaching love but are spending night of the time preaching who to hate. And I'm like, I don't need a preacher to tell me who to hate or who to love for that matter, but teach me how to do these things. You know, share with me ways that I can love my mother, love my brother, love my neighbors, you know, love people that are unlike me or that look different from me or different skin colors and so forth. So I think there's a huge, you know, off course there with, you know, preaching, you know, hate in the sense of, you know, creating like these little cliches within the religious community of we're superior, and we do that by making someone else feel inferior. And I totally disagree with that.
Now, is there a difference between religion and spirituality?
Absolutely. I see the difference in religion as, you know, religion is something that is like taught, and we're brought into the universe, and we're taught what religion is. I think spirituality, to me, is our inherent connection to the source, to the universe that created us. God, in this case, which I don't, you know, I talk about in the book. I don't like getting into like naming these things because something like God, I think, are unnameable. But to put them into the context and try to give names to them, sometimes we give it more of a we discredit the source. So spirituality, I mean, which is the side that I identify with, is my own connection to the universe. I mean, if I was given free will by the universe, why have someone else here to direct my path and direct the way I go? You know, so, you know, that's the difference for me as far as taught and then just the inherent connection to the universe.
You talk about enlightenment, spiritual awareness, and you say that takes courage and self-thinking.
Absolutely. We have to get back to thinking for ourselves. When you look at anything, and I use the Bible, you know, for this because that's one of the most widely read books, but because things are purported and they're repeated, you know, 2,500 years down the road, you're just repeating doesn't make them any more accurate than they were initially the first time they were mentioned. So I think it's very important that we not lose sight of the things that are coming to us by others, as opposed to thinking for ourselves. Now, there's some reason that I have my own mind. I mean, it's not there just for other people to fill it up. So that's what, you know, minding your life is about. It's like, you know, tapping into my own mind. I can think for myself, and it may not be. And most of the time, it will not be along, you know, societal norms or dogmas of what society lays out for us.
Here's another heading in part four. It says the social club. What is that?
I equate that, see, to the what the church to me has become, which is I think it's become a huge social club, and I think we have lost. We've totally lost sight of the message that even Christ taught. Christ came along in the New Testament, and he raised the standard of love and everything, love and acceptance to a whole new level. But I think we find today is churches, you know, people show up to be part of a clique and a part of the club. It's one of the same things that give us all the different, you know, religious bodies, you know, all serving, you know, the same God or Christ per se. And so you create these social clubs where it's all about just showing up on a future Sunday, and I can live the type of life that I want to Monday through Saturday, but long as Sunday, you know, I show up and I can pretend to espouse the views that I'm embracing on Sunday. So yeah, I think that's a major issue in this country, as opposed to just finding our own truth. Let's seek and find our own truth, who we are, you know, our connection to God and our connection to the universe.
After your years of, as you call it, confusion, anxiety, and depression, how do you feel now that you've published this book and you can share this with others?
Oh my! I am totally enthused. I mean, this book, initially this book started out as a journal of my life, Steve. It was never intended to even be a book. I was just writing a journal, and through inspiration, it became a book, you know, to help others. It was not written for, you know, financial gain. And I when I wrote this book, I said, you know, this book is to help others. I don't care if this book makes one dime. But I say that to say, now that the book is out, I mean, the stories that I get from people, I get like tons of emails, tons of letters from people every day, how their life has been empowered, how they've been enlightened by reading the book, how they've had a lot of these thoughts within themselves for a lot of years, but no one ever talked about them. They just didn't know how to say them, couldn't say them. So I feel wonderful. I've been picked up by a couple of national publications. I mean, the messages, I mean, it has exceeded even my expectation at the time I wrote the book. So I'm delighted. I'm delighted to be out sharing the story, even with churches and stuff that I've been doing here in Washington, D.C. Recently. So, yeah, it's a great time in my life.
The title of the book, Mind Your Own Life, The Journey Back to Love. And the author is Aaron Anson. Aaron, tell us how to get your book.
The book is available at independent bookstores, but Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. It's also available at my website, author signed copies, AaronAnson.com. I'm also on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter, Minding Your Life.
Aaron, thanks for being with us on Indie Book Publishing and this interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.